Hi, I'm Corbin Middlemass from ABC Cricket Podcast. And in case you missed it, the Ashes are on this summer. The Australia and England rivalry has never been bigger, so ABC Cricket Podcast is going bigger too. Join me and former Test opener Ed Cowan every Monday and Friday, and after every day of play for the best analysis in cricket. If you want every angle of the Ashes covered in depth, ABC Cricket Podcast is for you. Search for ABC Cricket Podcast on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
From Wandjeri Country, I'm Luke Siddham-Dundon, and today on The Breakfast Wrap.
It is just a wall of rain.
The Top End has experienced its worst cyclone in decades. So, how have residents in Darwin coped with a Category 3 storm?
There is a devastation everywhere in the sense of we have huge trees down on people's homes.
That's the NT Chief Minister. We'll hear from her in just a moment and find out why there are concerns of complacency come the next storm. Then all year, we've been tracking the political aftershocks from the federal election. Today, we'll go back to the original earthquake. That is the title of journalist and author Nikki Savva's fifth book, looking at the chaos of the last election.
The leader performed extremely badly. I do not believe that he had a single good day during that campaign. And they tried to win without policies, which was a debacle.
From the Radio National Breakfast team, this is The Breakfast Wrap. Well, depending on where you're listening to us from, you'll know this firsthand. It's been a weekend of wild weather right across the country. Huge hailstones in northern New South Wales and southern Queensland, record-breaking lightning in South Australia, and then in the Top End, Tropical Cyclone Fina, the most intense storm to pass over Darwin since 1974's Cyclone Tracy. For Darwin residents like Victoria, the accumulative anxiety from years of storms is a lot to deal with.
It just builds up and then you feel as if you can't go any further. But the anxiety is, you don't think you're going to get it, but I think I've been through Marcus after Tracy and there's about four other small ones, but just having the anxiety build up and just hit you. Mm. And I thought, gosh, I'm in my mid-70s. You know, I should be over it by now. I was 21 in Tracy.
And that is Darwin resident Victoria sharing that with ABC meteorologist Nate Byrne. So this storm is currently a Category 4 system. It's out at sea, it's tracking towards northeast Western Australia, where it'll probably calm down a bit before making landfall again. But it passed near Darwin as a Category 3. It downed trees, it left thousands without power, and it's closed more than a dozen schools in Greater Darwin today. Yet, experts are worried that this experience could drive complacency ahead of future storms.
The edges of it were around about 100 kilometres per hour that went over most of the city. So we've got to really think that, you know, those 100 kilometres per hour, you know, in the low Cat 1 type wind speeds for that, yeah, sure, the core of it, really, really scary. It's great that we all prepared and dodged the bullet with most of the severe wind speeds being well offshore. One of the things is that we shouldn't be thinking that we've survived this major wind speed and that, oh, everything's fine, I don't need to prepare in future. No, we need to do the preparation. We shouldn't be thinking that wind speed that we spent all night going through with Fina is the one that is related to those really destructive winds that are in the centre of the core of it.
And that was David Henderson, the chief engineer at the cyclone testing station at James Cook University. He said that in an interview that he gave on ABC Radio Darwin's cyclone coverage on Sunday night. So as Darwin residents woke, probably to the sound of chainsaws and mulchers working through all those felled trees in the city, we spoke with the Territory's Chief Minister, Leah Finocchiaro. She told Sally Sara just what residents have gone through over the weekend.
On the ground, we're really so proud to say there's been no significant injuries and no major loss of infrastructure, but there is devastation everywhere in the sense of we have huge trees down on people's homes, blocking their driveways. For example, we have 18 major traffic intersections that are still without power and about 15,000 homes who will be waking up this morning for the second time without power. So there's still plenty to do, but our very core focus is on recovery. I want business as usual as soon as possible. I've worked really hard with the emergency services team and our principals, and everyone has done an incredible job because we want kids back at school this morning. So of the 66 schools affected, 51 will be back in the classroom today, which is an incredible effort by the team.
Are there any other outlying areas in addition to Darwin, outside of Darwin, that have been affected or there's been much damage, Chief Minister?
No, luckily not. We've heard overnight. So the cyclone passed a remote Aboriginal community of Wadi, and they experienced destructive winds, but no major impacts, as did another smaller community of Dundee Beach. But Warramyunga is on the Tiwi Islands, and they experienced more intensity around the cyclone than Darwin did. But they have their power down. We're sending a team this morning because it's now safe to be able to travel to the Tiwis, and we want that power restored as soon as possible. So there's a lot of work to be done, but it's mainly the tree damage. So you can imagine our SES have been out cutting down trees to open roadways, open people's driveways, and make people safe and as comfortable as we possibly can at this time.
How are people going? What's the mood like in Darwin? You're out talking to people yesterday. What would you say?
Yeah, I think people are really relieved. They feel lucky, and I think that preparation work that we did incredibly early, we've been watching this closely since it was a low, and the public messaging has been strong and people were very much heeding the messages of our authorities. And so I think people feel that we got through it as a community. Certainly yesterday, there were a lot of people out. You could imagine being locked up in your home with your pets and your kids as, you know, it takes its toll on all of us. And so people were really happy to be out stretching their legs yesterday and just surveying the damage. But, you know, Territorians are very tough, Sally. And for a lot of people, it was their first cyclone. But as you spoke to your listener, you know, my dad was a Cyclone Tracy survivor, and it hits home really hard sometimes. So there's a mixed feeling out there, but people are just wanting to clean up and get on with the job.
We were talking earlier this morning on the program, Chief Minister, about concerns of complacency. This was listed as a Cat 3 cyclone, but it was more the edge of the cyclone that went over Darwin rather than the centre of the system where there may have been stronger winds. What's your message to people in Darwin about taking threats seriously in the future, even if they've got through this one relatively unscathed?
Yeah, I think there is always that degree of complacency, but I have to say it has been an excellent community response. We stood up our emergency operations centre very early and had lots of clear, consistent public messaging. So people did do the right thing. And the evidence of that, Sally, is that the cyclone actually intensified and hit earlier than we expected, but everyone was ready. So I think this is just a reminder for everyone that this is real and that we do need to be prepared, and that when you are prepared, you can get through it as we have done. So the cleanup will continue for weeks, but our real concern is getting power on as soon as possible and clearing roadways.
How's business coped with what happened, what unfolded on the weekend?
Our business community is amazing. We saw people, particularly those who sell food and important goods that you need. I mean, everyone is expected in the top end of the territory to have a cyclone kit. You are required to be able to look after yourself and your family and pets in your home for 72 hours. So you need canned goods because you might not have any power. You need clean drinking water, blankets, all those, you know, medication, nappies, whatever you might need to go it alone essentially for a few days. So, you know, people have done that really, really well. And I just am so proud to be Territorian. The community did this really well. And our emergency teams are just 10 out of 10, exceptional effort.
And you were just listening to the Northern Territory Chief Minister, Leah Finocchiaro, there on severe tropical cyclone Fina. Now, of course, depending on where you are, you can stay up to date with all the latest information on this system. You can get that on ABC Local Radio, on the Listen app, and also on ABC News. Now, while we're talking weather, we have to talk about the Weather Bureau, and more specifically, its new website. It's been heavily criticised for the updates. Some have called it confusing and hard to navigate, particularly leading into summer. The Federal Environment Minister has already asked the agency's new boss to examine just how the revamp went so wrong and then report back to him. This morning we had Murray Watt on to discuss other issues. But on the weekend, it was revealed that the cost of this new website was not $4 million, as the Bureau had previously stated, but instead $96.5 million. Here's the question Sally Sarah posed to the Minister about that news.
We've learned that the relaunch and changes to the Bureau of Meteorology website, so the total cost of that's around $96 million. Mm. Is that too much?
You would have seen, Sally, that I've already said that I've got very serious concerns about how this website change was managed. As soon as the issues came to light a couple of weeks ago, or maybe a month ago now.
But this cost is much higher than we initially understood.
It is, mm. and I think the BOM has got some explaining to do about that. We do have a new CEO of the BOM who only started 2 weeks ago after this all occurred. I met with him on his very first day. I've met with him since, so twice in his first fortnight, and made very clear to him that I want him to get on top of the issues around the website, not just continue making changes to make it more usable, but get on top of how we got to this situation in the first place.
So when there was initial negative reaction, I think the number that was being thrown around was around $4 million. Mm. Did you know at that time that the real cost was 96? Had the BOM told you that?
What the BOM had said to me was that there were other elements of the website design that did increase the costs. I don't think that I was aware of that total cost of $96 million. I certainly knew that it was more than four, and my recollection is that there were media reports at the time that said that the $4 million related to just the website design, but there was a lot of back-of-house activity that had costed more. But I understand that people are very concerned about that amount of money, and that's why I've asked the new CEO to get on top of what occurred.
And that's the Environment Minister, Murray Watt, there, speaking to Sally Sarah on Radio National Breakfast. Nikki Savva has been one of the sharpest political observers for decades. She was there in Old Parliament House when Whitlam was sacked and replaced by Fraser.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen.
She even crossed to the other side as a staffer for the Liberal Party before returning to journalism and commentary. She's tracked the rise and fall of governments and published a number of books on the political calamities of our time. Her title, Bulldozed, charted the fall of Scott Morrison, and before that, the demise of Malcolm Turnbull was documented in Plots and Prayers. A few years prior, The Road to Ruin showed how Tony Abbott and Peter Credlin destroyed their own government. So there's been a lot of anticipation for her take on the last disastrous election for the coalition, the one that downed Peter Dutton and delivered Labor its greatest electoral victory in decades. The book is called Earthquake, the election that shook Australia. And she came on with Sally to discuss.
You did a lot of interviews with a lot of politicians for this book. What surprised you?
Well, I guess I was surprised by the depth of the divisions inside the Liberal Party leading up to the election. I was surprised by the seeming unpreparedness of Dutton. I was surprised by how badly he campaigned for someone who had been around politics for such a long time. And put together, I would have to say it was the worst campaign that I've ever covered. And I think I counted up about 20. And there were quite a number of reasons for that. A breakdown of trust between the main players inside the parliamentary party, then between Dutton and campaign headquarters. Dutton narrowing his circle of advice and thinking that he could win by using the same tactics that he used in the Voice referendum, which was to just be negative about everything and to say no and not to have some alternative prescriptions for people, mainly on cost of living.
There was loyalty at the same time. No one spoke up to say, listen, or effectively, listen, we're in a lot of trouble here.
Mm. They had this idea that Dutton knew what he was doing because he had been winning a marginal seat for so many elections, that they had won the Voice referendum, and that, you know, he thought, and they believed him, that he had a golden touch with suburban voters, when in fact all that turned out to be wrong, wrong, wrong. So even at the most critical moment, I believe, when Dutton decided inside the budget lockup to vote against the tax cut, $5 a week tax cut, yes, which was pretty measly, but it was symbolic of something, right? Mm. And to allow the party to go to an election and have Labor to be the party of lower taxes. Mm. For them to have allowed that to happen, yes, they objected. They tried to convince him not to oppose it and to come up with an alternative, but he wouldn't. And yet they felt that even at that stage they couldn't roll him. It was too late, so they just went along.
How important is it to remember for context that, you know, Labor had a very strong victory in this election, but towards the end of 2024, it wasn't looking that great for Labor. There were a lot of concerns. What turned things around?
It was looking very grim. He was off his game. Elbow was off his game. There's no doubt about that. People who are close to him say that the defeat of the referendum knocked him around a lot more than people realised, because he had felt that he had let people down and that it was a great moral defeat for the country. So he was really affected by that, and he kind of dropped his bundle a bit. But I think the realisation over Christmas that if he didn't pull his finger out and if they didn't get their act together, that he would go down as a one-termer, forced him to focus his mind. But also he had very good people around him whose advice he trusted, like Paul Erickson, the National Secretary, like Jim Chalmers, like Katie Gallagher and Penny Wong. And he spent the two-week break that he had really pulling himself together. They formulated a fair number of their policies inside that period. And by January 2, he was ready to go. He was ready to hit the campaign trail. And his colleagues pleaded with him to wait a few more days. So he did. He waited until January 6. Then he burst out of the blocks and announced the $7 billion in funding for the Bruce Highway. And one of his close friends, Darcy Byrne, said to me later, he willed himself to do it. He literally, you know, willed himself to do it, because facing the prospect of defeat and again letting people down was not something that he wanted to do. So he campaigned a hell of a lot better also in 2025 than he did in 22, and that counted for a lot. So, I mean, there were two stories in that campaign. One was how well Labor constructed its campaign and how well their leader performed. And on the other side, the leader performed extremely badly. I do not believe that he had a single good day during that campaign, and they tried to win without policies, which was a debacle.
Nikki Sava there, veteran political journalist and author of Earthquake, the election that shook Australia. All right, well, let's leave politics and turn to the home. One in six Australian couples face infertility issues, but until recently, clinical guidelines really just looked at female causes of infertility. That is until now. panel of fertility experts has developed the first Australian evidence-based guidelines on male fertility to assist specialists in finding the root causes of infertility. It also will help men to manage the significant stress associated with infertility. Dr. Lisa O'Donnell is one of the researchers behind these new guidelines. She gave us a sense of just how widespread male infertility is in Australia.
It is difficult to estimate, as you can imagine, because not all men line up to get a fertility test. But we do know that it is common, more than you would think. It's estimated to affect about 8 to 9% of males. But I think a really important statistic that we have very good data for is that when a couple goes to assisted reproduction, like IVF, male infertility is a contributing factor to half of all of those cases. And in fact, to up to 30% of those cases, it's the sole factor. So it's a very common thing.
That reality, has there been a gap between that and the focus of research when it comes to infertility?
Yes, I guess. Plenty of people like me researching male infertility. It's difficult to get funding at times, you know. Infertility is not necessarily seen to be a really important thing in terms of needing to understand it, because a lot of it, or if not most of it, can be treated by IVF, if you like. Mm-hmm. But certainly it's very important to understand, you know, how a man can optimise his sperm count so that he and his partner can conceive naturally. Obviously, you know, when a couple goes to IVF, the treatment focuses on the woman. You know, she's the one going through the hormones and the egg pickups and all those things. So, you know, it's really important that men be able to improve their fertility naturally so that, you know, they can avoid the expense of going to IVF.
What do we know? What are some of the things that the evidence tells us are helpful for men who want to improve their fertility?
So there's lots of different causes of male infertility, and obviously in some men it's genetic. But the thing that's really important is that they really need to go to see a clinician. And I think one of the biggest advances of these guidelines is it tells clinicians and couples when a woman is going to see a doctor because she's worried about her fertility, her male partner should be going as well. And so the male, just like the female, simultaneously they should be seeing GPs and then being referred to fertility specialists. Historically, women have borne the brunt of this responsibility and have felt that it's all them, and especially if their partner hasn't been tested for his sperm count, so, you know, they just think it's all their fault. So we're hoping that by getting these guidelines out there, it actually encourages men to get tested much earlier.
Lisa, do we really fully understand what can cause infertility in men?
So there are some lifestyle factors that certainly impact on a man's chances of fertility. So if a man has a reasonably low sperm count to begin with, there are things that can that lower his sperm count further. So heat is one of them. The sperm in the testes develop at about 2 degrees cooler than the rest of the body. So keeping a man's testes cool is actually quite important for optimal fertility. So it could mean loose-fitting clothes and don't sit in saunas and don't have your laptop directly on your lap. But really, very similar to what women are advised, men are advised that they can improve their chance of fertility by not smoking, avoiding excess alcohol, maintaining a healthy weight, not taking steroids for sports performance or bodybuilding because they really interfere with a man's hormones and the functioning of his testes. But certainly to improve a man's sperm counts, we advise him to maintain a healthy weight.
And that was Griffith University's Dr. Lisa O'Donnell, one of the researchers behind these new guidelines, ending the breakfast wrap for today. Well, thank you very much for listening to our first episode this Monday. We'll be here right across the week. Every interview presented by Sally Sara and produced by the ABC Radio National Breakfast team. And today's breakfast wrap was produced by Ted O'Connor. I'm Luke Sidham-Dundon. See you tomorrow.